Ah, the family car. We each remember our treasured childhood vehicle differently, for it contained multitudes, road trips, soccer gear, melted gummy bears, questionable air conditioning, an assortment of useless maps, one door that sort of doesn't work. But what does the term family car mean to the auto industry? That simple question has led to some dramatically different vehicles. The family segment has had to evolve and change with the times, perhaps more than any other type of car. Car companies are constantly having to think of ways to sell old-fashioned practicality to a new generation of car buyers. But what drives those innovations? And are today's sleek and speedy family vehicles really that different from the boats of yesteryear? Today on Past Gas, we're going to be stuck in the middle seat between our two cousins while Dad sings along to Steely Dan's greatest hits, because we're going on a journey with the family car.
Past Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about forts.
What were your guys' family cars when you were a kid? Like, what did your parents drive you around in?
Well, our first one was a Taurus wagon.
Oh.
That's a good one.
Dark blue.
We had a we had a Wagoneer.
That's a good one, too.
Jeep Wagoneer, really cool
classic car.
I might get one day when I have room. Then we had a Dodge Caravan. Mm-hmm. That was a huge piece. I remember it breaking down one day.
What color was that?
Like a dark blue. And then we had a Volvo 740.
Nice.
And when you turned the steering wheel, it would honk.
What? Every time?
Yeah. And so we would.
The good thing is you don't turn that much when you drive.
Yeah. My whole family would just like wave at people. Because we'd like turn and be like, ha! And we'd be like, hi.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
What about you, Joe?
So we had a conversion van. It was a Chevy Astro.
Nice.
That had a tint. It had Venetian blinds. It had airline lights. It had a little plug for an N64 in the front.
That's sick.
We never put our N64 in there. But we also had a Dodge Caravan. That's the one that got stolen, and I had to go identify the do-rag. But yeah, we took three huge road trips in the Astro van, and it's that smell after a road trip is very distinct, and if I smell French fries. Yeah, or like kind of like stale orange juice from McDonald's.
Yep.
I turned an Astro van into a convertible one time.
Oh, that's fun.
Oh, yeah. With Dan Brockett. After the wagon, we then got a Ford Windstar minivan, 98. And then after that, we got the Chrysler Town and Country. All minivans.
Yeah. Minivans aren't really a thing anymore.
No, not really, which is kind of sad because honestly, they're like the best high school car, I think.
Yeah.
Like if you have a nice, or not a nice minivan, but just like a minivan that runs.
Yeah.
You got a bunch of room for your friends. So many minivans over railroad tracks.
Yeah. That Chrysler had the, I think, a Pentastar V6, and it had a surprising amount of torque.
My parents just got a Grand Caravan. And
a Grand Caravan? The new one?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was 2019 or something. But
is one of them in a wheelchair?
Oh, sorry. Grand Caravan, not Grand Wagoneer. I was thinking.
No.
Goddamn.
No, I don't like the new Wagoneer. It's huge.
So
massive.
But no, they got a new Grand Caravan.
So that's the nice.
And
the
I
nice
drove it up
one.
The coast.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Coming from the 4Runner, I was like, whoa, I can actually go up a hill in this thing.
No, minivans are awesome. Okay, maybe they're awesome. I may have overstepped.
No, they're awesome.
I think if you want to be on the next wave of something, I think minivans.
You think they're going to make a comeback?
I think so. When we were at the donut, at the VidCon party that we had a couple weeks ago out at K1 Anaheim, someone showed up with the Previa.
Oh, yeah.
The mid-engine.
The supercharged one?
He had the supercharged mid-engined rear-wheel drive minivan. It was dumped. It had sick wheels on it.
They also come in manual, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if his
midship.
Was. It was midship. That's right. He put like racing seats in it and everything. It was really cool. I forget the guy's name. I'm sorry. But like that thing was so cool. And I was like, dude, I mean, minivans are plentiful. They're not fast, but like they're unique. And I think that's pretty cool. Like,
yeah, you can get a caravan with a turbo 2.4 and a manual.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that was like the first gen. Yeah, that's cool. That's pretty sick. So yeah, Previas are cool. I think our buddy Sean has one of those.
Sean's got one. He had like a car meet at his place, and there's like probably 50 amazing $1 million cars. And then he's like, oh, I got something for you guys. And he pulls the Previa around.
Yeah.
And we're all like, whoa. But he had it redone. He has like some nice tires.
Yeah, he went and like found a bunch of the original like interior. The exterior is still a little beat up, but the interior is like brand new. It's like, really cool.
I know you guys were gonna like this.
Yeah.
Nolan, why don't you tell everybody who we are?
Oh yeah, this is the show. I forgot. Welcome to Past Gas. I got so excited by the family vehicles, I forgot to do the host intros. My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm joined as always by my co-hosts, my friends, my mentors. We got Joe Weber.
Welcome, Slime Nation. Keep it winked.
And James Pumphrey.
I'm going to burn their crops and salt the earth.
Wow. And yeah, this week we're talking about the evolution of the family vehicle in the automotive industry. You know, history kind of repeats. Or it doesn't repeat. It rhymes. I don't know who said that first. But I don't think the crossover SUV. Mm-hmm. Most popular segment in the U.S.
I have one.
You've got one.
I have a performance CUV.
And you don't even have a family.
I guess I don't.
I don't think they're that different from...
I'd like to.
The idea is not that different from the huge like post-war sedans of the 1940s and 50s. Mm-hmm. You know, get... sedan ride quality with the enough space for an SUV, bam, you got a crossover. Mm-hmm. You know, just the form and the shape has changed. The idea has not. So that's kind of the idea behind this episode, is we're going to go through and take a look at the most, probably the most important segment in the automotive industry, the family.
Family. Family. Family.
So, yeah, a little different than our usual topics. No, I don't know if we're going to be mentioning any race car drivers this week. Maybe. Maybe some were involved.
But I think we might have Lee Iacocca in here.
I hope so. And, yeah, no trips to the Nürburgring.
Well, I don't know. We might mention the Renault Espace or whatever it's called. Espace.
The one that...
The F1 that engine.
Put the F1 engine in.
E-bussy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we got that mentioned in, so we're covered on that. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the family car. If you want to get technical, the first family vehicle was also the first vehicle, period. When Bertha Benz took her husband and business partner Carl's invention, the Benz patent motor wagon, for a long distance field test in 1888, she split the driving duties with her two teenage sons and officially invented the family road trip. We actually did a whole episode about Bertha Benz's big drive a while back, if you want to check that out. It's a really good story. They had to stop for fuel at pharmacies.
And then they ran out of fuel on a mountain and had a bunch of people, farmers, push them up the mountain or something like that.
Very nice. How courteous of them. The auto industry spent the next several decades focused on making cars reliable and profitable. So it took a while for both demand and technological capability to grow beyond cars that go from point A to point B. But even in the early days of horseless carriages, one of the first varieties of car to emerge was the station wagon. That's right, baby. I miss our Taurus wagon. I think it was cool. I miss my Taurus, my first car. MT5. Apparently it was super rare. Because there's a manual Taurus that wasn't a show. And also was the least powerful Taurus you can buy. So I don't know why they even built it in the first place. But I miss it.
Are you having a stroke?
Yes. I had a Red Bull right before I started. So I'm like, I'm bouncing around. There are a couple of fundamental things that make a station wagon a station wagon. It must be based on a car platform, but with the roof extended backward over a passenger and or cargo space that can be accessed through the rear door. Most of the time, they also have folding or removable seats for extra cargo space, but are built on the same wheelbase and drivetrain of a sedan. That we can agree on, right?
Yes.
Let's agree on that. Are backward seats still legal?
Yeah, Teslas have them.
You can really? Option a Teslas with them, yeah.
What?
Yeah. Historically, the term station wagon referred to improvised extra-large taxis used by railroad stations to transport upper-class clientele around busy train terminals.
Oh, like a train station.
Yes, or to go to and from hotels. Back then, they were also colloquially known as depot hacks because they worked around train depots as hackney carriages. It was an immensely creative time.
I'm glad they didn't go with depot hacks for station wagons.
That's kind of cool. Hey, how about you hop in a depot hack?
Audi RS6 depot hack.
Okay, that does sound kind of lame. Whatever they're called, though, they're generally manufactured per order by small-scale wagon builders and built with a wooden frame and bench seating on top of a truck chassis. Eventually, wagon builders started advertising in upscale magazines like Country Life, selling their wagons to private buyers for the first time. You know, coach-built situation, built to order, to your specifications.
I'd like to order a wooden car, please.
And I'd like a coach to build it. All right, gentlemen.
In 1923, Durant Motors became the first car company to offer a factory-built station wagon. Durant Motors was founded by William C. Durant, who, one, previously co-founded General Motors, and two, had the middle name Crapo.
Only my son Crapo. What a mean joke.
Durant Motors, unfortunately, though, quickly went belly up, as did other subsequent wagon-specific companies with names like York, Ionia, and Hercules. It wasn't until 1929 that one of the major auto manufacturers got into the station wagon game, when Ford introduced its very own consumer wagon, a modified version of the Model A. The Model A was Henry Ford's successor to the Model T. It was designed to easily swap out many different body styles, including coupe, roadster, convertible, town car, truck even, and for the first time, as part of a regular catalog, an extra-long, wood-sided, three-row station wagon.
You know, you can find Model A's on Craigslist for, like, not that expensive.
Yeah, they're once the boomers start all dying out.
All yeah, then we'll have our hands on all those nice Model A's.
Get all those greasy fingers all over them old boomer cars.
Should do a high-low Model A.
I think that'd be actually pretty sick.
It's one of the worst performing up to speeds ever.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Ford's wagon was a modest success. They sold all 5,200 of that specific model produced in 1929. But that accounted for just a tiny fraction of the 4.86 million Model A's sold between 1928 and 1931.
Whoa, that is a lot of cars.
Yeah, that's over a million per year.
Ford clearly wasn't that interested in wagons, which opened the door for other car companies to begin exploring the market for a large passenger vehicle, if not exactly a family car. They found that rich folks in particular were eager to buy larger cars. In fact, by the late 1930s, sleek, wood-bodied station wagons like the original Chrysler Town & Country, aka Woody's, became insanely popular in affluent communities, and with good reason. They looked pretty sick. Unfortunately, they also required constant maintenance. The wood had to be revarnished, and bolts would come loose because the panels expanded and contracted as the weather changed.
Yeah, I would imagine wood is not a great building material for cars.
Better than straw.
It is better than straw.
Oh, it is better. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Mm-hmm. Good call. Stupid. In 1935, Chevy introduced the Carryall Suburban, which later became known as just the Suburban. The original Suburban was based on a similar all-metal car built for the National Guard, specifically designed to resemble the popular Woody wagons. This is generally considered the first all-steel wagon, although it was so huge that some people consider it a light truck.
It's a big truck.
It's a big old truck.
It's a heavy truck. It wasn't until after World War II that station wagons became an essential part of the auto industry. In the 1950s, several post-war changes to American life increased the demand for roomier, more comfortable cars. The economy was flourishing. Babies were booming. Mm-hmm. And young urbanites were leaving cities behind for sprawling suburbia. Then in 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the D stands for...
Dookie.
pushed through the... He's on the dime.
I never knew that.
That's what the D stands for, dime.
Oh.
I hope I never have to touch a dime ever again.
Really? It's the littlest coin. It's cute.
I just don't. I can't wait to wash my hands whenever I get a handful of change now.
I swallow dimes.
Yeah. Just
every time I get one, I swallow it.
It's like when cows eat rocks so they can or.
It's birds.
Birds?
Yeah, you're something an idiot.
Because they don't have gallstones.
Oh, well, no. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it's birds. Cows chew cud.
They chew their cud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, forget about it, Cud.
That's actually my middle name, Cud.
Cud? Yeah. Joe Cud Weber?
Joe Cud.
Joe Cud.
It's kind of like a cool...
Joey Cuds.
Joey Cuds.
Joe Cud Weber sounds like an assassin.
Yeah, Joe Cud Weber. His name was Joe Cud Weber.
Anyway, Dwight Dime Eisenhower pushed through the passage of the Federal Aid Highway Act, which built 40,000 miles of new highway linking all American cities with more than 50,000 people. Wow. Eisenhower was inspired by his experiences crossing the country in a 1919 Army convoy along the Lincoln Highway, the first road across America. Eisenhower said, "The old convoy had started me thinking about good two-lane highways, the wisdom of broader ribbons across our land." That's how people talked back then.
All of them.
Let us know if you want us to do an entire episode on that story. The new ribbon that he was referring to was a highway system, and it was more modern and better paved than old roads like the Lincoln Highway, allowing for much easier access to distant locales. Suddenly, the family vacation no longer relied on train or boat tickets, and very quickly, having a station wagon in the driveway came to define the typical modern middle-class American family. Car companies jumped at the increased demand, making larger wagons with 6 or even 9 passenger seating to accommodate larger families. Dude, if you have a 9-person family, you're a psychopath.
Well, this is the 50s when they were like, I need 9 children to support me in my old age.
Yeah, they need to work the farm. I think if you have over 3 kids now, you're nuts.
These days?
Yeah. I want 2.
Yeah, 2 is a pretty good number.
Because then you're like carbon positive with the earth. If it's 2 people making 2 people, that's a wash.
Yeah. 0 sum.
Yeah.
Station wagons were big cars and big business. In 1955, Ford built 209,000 wagons, accounting for nearly 15% of Ford's overall vehicle sales. Perhaps the defining full-size station wagon of this era was the Ford Country Squire.
Well, I'm just a humble country squire. Oh, this thing's pretty sick.
The Country Squire was introduced as a 2-door Woody in 1950 and continued onward for 8 generations, surviving just about every possible design change along the way. Even in these relatively early days of family cars, automakers were already trying to create innovative conveniences to help their models stand out. Ford hit on one in 1966 with the magic door gate. For the Country Squire.
Door gate. We're talking about door gate, everybody.
Talking about door gate, guys.
Cool. It's
a door scandal. It was developed by Donald N. Fry. The N stands for nachos. He's one of the same guys who created the Mustang.
Hmm.
The magic door gate allows the rear door to fold down like a regular tailgate or hinge open to the side like a passenger door.
That's sick. That's sick.
I wish more cars had that.
Every car should have that.
For sure. I love a fold-down tailgate. Mm-hmm. Sit on it.
Yeah.
Drink iced tea.
Play some cards.
Lemonade. Eat some pasta salad.
2 drinks, dude?
Huh?
2 drinks?
1 drink. It's called an Arnold Palmer.
What's it called again?
An Arnold Palmer. Try and keep up. In 1969, things got even more magic when they figured out how to make it open up like a hatchback as well.
What?
What the crap?
How does that even work?
I'm a relatively smart guy, and I can't visualize it. It sounds kind of remedial these days, but at the time, it was pretty revolutionary. It does not sound remedial.
Amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Dude, I want this. That's so cool.
There's nothing that parents appreciate more than convenience. Well, they probably appreciate their kids being alive. And a
yeah.
door that can easily load in kids or animals or luggage or dead bodies is pretty dang convenient. At 19 feet long, powered by a V8 engine, the Country Squire was a big, bad family behemoth. Its popularity helped station wagons hit their cultural peak in the 1970s and 80s. By 1971, the Country Squire was selling 130,000 vehicles by itself. Kids of the era were delighted by its side-facing seats, magnetic checkerboard.
What?
Optional CB radio or hidden rear cargo compartment.
Dude, this thing's so cool.
It even inspired the wagon family truckster, Chevy Chase's car in National Lampoon's Vacation. Pretty much every car company out there came up with a competing wagon. From the exotic Chevy Nomad to the ultra-huge Pontiac Safari to the virtually indestructible Mercedes-Benz 300 TD. By the mid-70s, full-size station wagon sales started to sag. Like my pants. I'm eating only cold food this summer, and I'm sagging.
You're bringing back sagging.
Yeah, I'm bringing back sagging. So if you're listening to this and you like to sag, post a picture on Instagram and tag me at James Pumphrey.
What's the hashtag?
Hashtag sagging ain't wrong. First, the 1973 oil crisis caused gas shortages and 400% price hikes, which made families question the value of a honkin' V8. Meanwhile, smaller, more efficient wagons like the Toyota Corolla and Volkswagen Passat entered the market, slowly eating away at sales of bigger models like the Country Squire. Demand for family cars didn't rebound until the mid-80s, and by that point, Chrysler was about to shake up the industry.
Oh, we're going to see a little change in the tide here.
Like so many martinis ordered by James Bond. I'm a big Bond guy.
Big Bond guy, yeah. This Country Squire, dude. I like it. That's cool. Is it stupid that I want to put an angle kit on everything I see now?
I think that you should just get as many pounds of car as you can.
What does that mean?
Yeah,
wait. Like he's got probably 7,000 pounds of car right now.
You need
to get more heavy cars.
Yeah.
So you have the heaviest car collection in the world.
It's crazy that you have two cars that don't even weigh how much that Hummer weighs, the new Hummer.
That is weird, yeah. I think, what,
9,000? Yeah.
Sheesh. Sheesh.
Sheesh. All right.
That's bussing.
That's
it's pushing Major P.
That kind of burned out, huh?
Yeah. No cap.
Turns out the other guy who created the Mustang won... Lee Iacocca was also interested in revolutionizing family transportation. After clashing with Henry Ford II, or Hank the Deuce, and getting fired in 1978, Iacocca took over as the head of Chrysler. The company was on the verge of bankruptcy, but Iacocca managed to get it back on track thanks to practicality, particularly by introducing the reliable and multi-use K-Car platform. He also brought over a project rejected by Ford called the Mini Max, aimed at bringing the sliding door and high ceiling convenience of a conventional van to a smaller vehicle chassis. In 1983, Chrysler presented the results, the Dodge Caravan, the first modern minivan. By stretching the Chrysler K-Car platform, lowering the floor, and adding car amenities, Chrysler established the Caravan as the leading minivan template. It also foreshadowed some of the concepts behind the crossover SUV's popularity today.
I wonder what the need was to go from station wagon to minivan.
Kidnapping?
You can kidnap someone in a station wagon.
It's easier with a sliding door.
Well,
oh.
One thing to keep in mind is that these minivans, because it's based on the K-Car platform, it's front-wheel drive, and it has a more fuel-efficient engine. Since we're transitioning from the 70s into the 80s, All these big station wagons that we talked about, most of them are sold with small block V8s or very thirsty, straight six engines or V6 engines, but mostly V8s. So the fuel economy is horrible. Because they were also based on like, we'll say muscle car platforms or architecture, they also had like truck suspension too. So they weren't the most comfortable. Whereas these new K cars, for the time, more economical and more comfortable and lighter.
Damn, that was a really succinct answer. Thanks.
You're welcome, Joe.
Yeah, man, you killed that.
You think you're better than this?
You think you're a professor of hands at Harvard? You think you're better than Joe?
No.
Because it seems like you think you're better than Joe.
Joe asked a question, you answered. Talked out of my ass about minivans for a minute.
You have a Harvard accent when you say it. So
you talk with a Harvard accent, you think you're better?
Think it better because I don't know words.
You think you're fucking better than me?
You're not a cop.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
As one ad described the caravan, it was designed to, quote, take the place of an economy car, sporty car, station wagon, and van. And it worked.
Ooh, oh, good. Good thing.
The caravan and its variant siblings, the Plymouth Voyager and the redesigned Chrysler Town & Country, combined to sell 209,000 vans in their first model year, 1984, and virtually saved Chrysler from financial doom.
Rest in peace.
By 1991, Chrysler's vehicles accounted for half of all minivans built across the industry. By the latter part of the 90s, Chrysler was selling upwards of 600,000 minivans each year. God
Lee
bless.
Lee Iacocca was eating steak every night.
Yeah, Lee Iacocca was having steak and baked potato every day. Six whiskeys at lunch.
The change in consumer demands once again mirrored social shifts and a new economic boom, which was driven in part by many women joining the workplace for the first time. Families with dual incomes wanted more space and more amenities, which minivans provided better than any other car up to that point. The boxy design and high roof maximized interior space. A sliding door meant you could easily stuff...
Children. Other children, not your children.
I was going to say half a Little League team in there. And since it was built on a small car platform, it fit in the same parking space as a sedan. But the huge cargo area and rear hatch let it carry everything a suburban family might want to haul.
Like a dog's.
Like a dog's. Another thing that helped the rise of the minivan, they were classified as light trucks. This meant that under the U.S. corporate average fuel economy standards enacted in 1975, vans were held to a looser efficiency standard than smaller cars. Meanwhile, station wagons were classified the same as sedans and thus had a hard time complying with fuel restrictions. In a weird way, the fuel economy standards actually incentivized automakers to produce larger vans with worse fuel economy. So it sounds like my pontificating about all the benefits of the minivan were actually just undercut by shirking regulations.
What are the words you're saying? Shirking?
Yeah. Yeah, it was Mr. Harvard over here.
Is that a Harvard word?
Yeah, Harvard word you learned at Yale.
Are you part of the Bones Brigade?
Yeah, are you part of the Bones Brigade?
Secret?
Did you jerk off in front of your dad?
No. The Bones Brigade?
Isn't that the secret thing that all presidents are part of?
Yeah.
Well, I did jerk off in front of Dwight Dookie Eisenhower. Ashes.
Yeah. No.
You made a little glue out of it.
Okay.
A little cement.
Paper mache. This is making me think about my dad a lot. Not the last conversation, but anytime we ever go to a restaurant and we get seated right away and then a bunch of people show up after us, he always goes, well, we got here at the right time.
We got here right on time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without fail. Yeah. Like I can see it coming.
Yeah.
Well, if there's like traffic on the other side of the highway, he's like, glad we're not going that way.
Yeah. You check your moles out, Joe? Do you go to the dermatologist? You guys,
I need some moles checked out for sure.
I have a weird thing on my arm. I'm Let's pretty sure it's bad.
I thought you were gonna point to your tattoo.
It's the darker the worse, but that doesn't look that dark.
Oh, little dot right there?
Yeah.
Guys, how about we organize like a group trip?
A group trip to the dermatologist.
Yeah. We could always save money if we all chip in. You know?
Can we get a coupon? Discounted rate.
We all have to get naked in front of each other.
Yeah,
not a problem.
We should just get one to come to the office and check out all our moles.
That'd be pretty funny.
That'd be funny. If you guys want to see us get our moles checked out live on YouTube.
On an audio format.
You can hear us get them lanced.
I do have a pretty big one on my neck.
Okay, let's stop talking about moles.
You brought it up.
Do you guys want us to dedicate an entire podcast to our moles and growths? Let us know in the comments.
Yeah. Just like with the station wagon, Chrysler's success bred many imitators. There is the Ford Aerostar, the Toyota Sienna, and the Honda Odyssey, and more. Most of them copied the caravan's blueprint pretty much to a T. Rather than further experiment with the form of the minivan, they mostly tried to top each other with interior upgrades like climate zone controls and TVs in the headrests. But Chrysler beat them all with the biggest minivan design innovation yet. It was, drumroll please... a second sliding door.
Ta-da!
These were lean days for invention, but high times for the car companies. The minivan officially conquered the station wagon in 1996, when the last American full-size wagons, the Buick Roadmaster and the Chevy Caprice Classic, were discontinued. The minivan market peaked shortly thereafter, with nearly 1.4 million vans sold in the year 2000.
So, I think the E46 wagon is the best-looking wagon of all time.
Hmm. No.
Really?
Way not.
Dude, in that light blue color, that's the best looking wagon of all time.
Very much no.
What's your favorite wagon?
Mercedes. Like, there's like eight Mercedes wagons that look better than it.
Yeah. I think Mercedes is a really good job.
E63 AMG wagon. Mm-hmm. Really good looking.
CTSV.
CTSV is
more angular. It looks like a brick of butter.
I know, but I like yeah. butter, you know? I think the
RS6 wagon looks better.
Yeah.
Audi A4, like B5 wagon, mm-hmm. looks better.
The E92, they made an E92 M3 wagon over in Europe, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that looks pretty good. I like that. I like the later one.
I'd say Audi A4. Dude, fucking Audi S2 looks better.
Are you kidding me, dude? Jordan Peele's E46 wagon in Get Out. Wait, he's not in that movie.
He directed it.
Daniel Kaluuya's E46 wagon in that movie is
it's
best.
A good looking car, don't get me wrong. I just don't think it's the best looking wagon of all time.
Okay.
I think the Taycan Sport Turismo.
Oh, Taycan Sport Turismo, the best looking car on the road.
Well, would you call that a shooting break? Does it fucking matter?
Yeah.
Do we need to get
Yeah, you're right. If you want to, yeah, that is more of a shooting break. Not really a station wagon.
Why? What's the difference?
It's like very little cargo room in the back.
There's none.
Yeah.
All of the body of that car is just does not reflect.
Yeah.
I don't understand how a car that long can have no back seat.
It has nothing.
You can fit in the back seat fine, but it's like.
Yeah, if you've got Wicked Witch of the West legs that can curl up.
I think like family car, for it to be really a family car, like you need to be able to like take your family camping with it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like have two to.
You're so 2.5, outdoorsy.
Yeah, 2.5 kids and enough room for camping stuff in the back. And the Taycan, you could not do that. You could not.
It's you crazy you not. Don't recognize your third kid as a full kid, dude.
Well, I don't know if it's between two or three, you know.
Yeah.
So I went with the average, 2.5.
I'm going to get castrated after this. Not even a vasectomy, just
full on.
All off of me.
Eunuched.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I can sing it falsetto after that.
Did Max really?
Sorry. On your knees and hear the angel's voices.
I know.
Oh, no. In the early 2000s, the minivan's greatest strengths, its practicality and spacious interior, flipped on a dime and made it exactly what people didn't want to drive. Gas prices suddenly fluctuated again. Now gas was cheap because we were at war. And at the same time, families were shrinking dramatically because everyone got castrated. According to the U.S. Census in 1969, 11% of households had more than six people in them. Gross. But by 2000, only 3.6% did. And so SUVs began to rise in popularity.
There was also like a weird wave of like
six people in a house.
A lot of people.
Yuck.
There's also like a weird shift in the like public perception of the minivan around this time, mm-hmm. too. It probably had to do with like everything else in culture at that time. Mm-hmm. But like it went from like being, hey, a car that everybody could use to being like, you're a bitch if you drive a minivan.
Oh, finally give up your balls.
Yeah.
What? Did your balls crawl into your butthole? This week on Mansers, how many cucks does it take to make a minivan?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would love to read like a
Maxim magazine article on the death of the minivan.
I'm not gonna say Maxim. I was gonna say like an essay on like this the culture of this the Spike TV culture that we had. You know?
Yeah.
Where like yellow cars were pretty common.
Yeah, you need yourself
you need
a yellow
Chevy
car.
SSR. Yeah.
You need
yellow.
A soul patch and a yellow car.
You know, a wide soul patch.
We're gonna go see Len in Pomona.
If you're if you drive a minivan, it means your wife knows karate. Can we forget about the thing I said when I was drunk? I didn't mean to call you that.
How many dogs can drive a car?
How many dogs does it take to rip your balls off?
What was the other one? How many fake boobs does it take to choke a dog?
Oh, the SUV as we know it today has many predecessors, most especially off-road military vehicles like the Willys MB Jeep and the British Land Rover. Term SUV first appeared in 1974 brochure for the Jeep Cherokee SJ, a two-door truck based on the Wagoneer. But it wasn't until 1984 and the updated four-door Cherokee XJ that drivers started to really notice SUVs as an option for more than off-roading. Ironically, despite their military origins, the rise of SUVs in commercial popularity came largely at the expense of family vans. Drivers liked sitting higher on the road and felt that the cars were safer to drive. SUVs had the same rear hatch, cargo capacity, and passenger space buyers had come to love in minivans, but driving one made you look like a freaking badass.
Not a little wimp whose wife knows karate.
That your wife knows karate. You don't even know what to do with nunchucks, but your wife uses them on you every night.
New from Taco Bell.
If you drive a minivan, it means that your wife pegs you. The popularity of SUVs captured several markets. Who wouldn't be caught dead in a van because it makes you look like you get pegged. Young people... movie stars, and even one O.J. Simpson.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right.
He almost cut two people's heads off.
That's definitely quiet.
In addition to Jeep, the Ford Explorer helped America embrace the SUV as a family car. While the Explorer had available four-wheel drive and was mounted on a frame similar to that of the Ford Ranger pickup, it was basically designed for the streets and incorporated important safety features such as airbags and reverse warning systems. It also flipped over quickly.
Yeah. My one of my childhood best friends, Andrew, shout out, saw him the other day.
What's his last name?
Andrew Bergdorf.
Okay. I've heard about this guy.
Yeah, Andrew Bergdorf. His family had one of these with the Eddie Bauer package.
Eddie Bauer edition. Yeah. Yeah.
There was one on Craigslist for sale. I follow cool Craigslist cars on Instagram. Mm-hmm. The original one had this really cool, like, asymmetrical grill.
Oh.
And it was a very boxy. It looked really good. But it also had this, like, this particular one had, like, cardinal red velour seats. Ooh. That were just in perfect condition. Mm. Yeah.
Velour. Mm,
velour. Cardinal red. I'm from Louisville. We love cardinal. The Explorer also showed why everyone deciding to commute in massive trucks might not be a good idea due to issues with rollovers and tire explosions.
We talked about this on an earlier episode.
Yeah, Ford really threw Firestone under the bus, so ended a 100-year friendship.
Mm-hmm. Go check it out.
Yeah, and they used to 69 with Thomas Edison.
Yep.
Firestone.
And Teddy Roosevelt was there.
Teddy Roosevelt was there, and they used to 69 on campus.
Amelia Earhart.
Amelia Earhart is back. You hear? You guys hear?
Yeah, she's been in Fiji the whole time.
Yeah, she's back.
Whoa, she's on Dancing with the Stars now, right?
Yeah, she's on Dancing with the Stars.
Pretty cool.
She looks great.
Yeah. That Fiji water really...
Mm-hmm. She's dating that Brody Jenner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's back, too.
Dang, wow, yeah.
I don't even know who Brody Jenner is. That's Bruce's son?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Caitlin,
sorry.
But the best example of the SUV as an almost one-to-one replacement for minivans was in 2002 with the Honda Pilot. Nolan used to have one of these. Shouts to Pilots.
Honda Passport.
Oh.
Isuzu Rodeo. Same car.
Oh, they're both travel themed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Amelia Earhart, Honda Pilot.
Amelia Dingleberry Earhart.
It had cavernous three-row seating like a minivan. The rear row of seats folded flat like a minivan. It had a DVD player and a moonroof like a minivan. It was even built on the same platform of the Honda Odyssey, which is a minivan. Follow the money, people. If you don't notice, you're not paying attention. The Pilot is essentially a repackaged van for people who aren't ready to admit that it's time to get a van that their wife knows karate.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
Honda does that quite a bit because the Ridgeline is based on like a car platform too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ridgeline, great truck.
Is it?
That's what I've heard.
People hate it for some reason.
Truck people hate it because it's unibody construction.
Yeah, Ridgeline owners. Ridgeline owners love it. Now, it would be interesting to see people's opinion on the front-wheel drive Maverick and see what they think about the Ridgeline as well.
I might get a Ridgeline. My buddy Nick Thune, one of the coolest dudes ever in the world.
He's got a Ridgeline?
Drives a Ridgeline.
Wow.
He's got great tattoos, amazing style. He's like
6'4". Great musician.
Great musician.
He's very funny.
Very funny.
We should have him in.
Sure.
Okay.
No comment.
Oh, he was mean to Joe.
Oh. But it's like everyone...
Maybe it's just you.
No, dude, I didn't say everyone. He was the dick. He was the biggest dick I've ever encountered at that stand-up show. John Mulaney, a wonderful guy.
John Mulaney was rude to me.
Oh, he was really nice to me. Johnny Pemberton is one of the sweetest dudes I've ever met.
One of my first friends in LA.
Yeah. Cameron Esposito.
Great. Very nice.
Okay.
John Mulaney was mean to me. However.
Did you spit gum into his mouth?
No, I used to do that. However, the Pilot, maybe my reputation precedes me. I used to be kind of an asshole. I used to be a real big piece of shit.
But I'm not anymore.
I'm such a narcissist, I kind of think that sketch is based on me.
Do you know him?
No.
No. That's
However, the Pilot is also one of the huge gas-guzzling SUVs that led to the next evolution of family cars. Just as the sport utility class was peaking with over-the-top huge trucks.
I'm peaking!
Blow Vicks in my face. I'm peaking. Just as the SUVs were peaking with over-the-top huge trucks like the Hummer H2 and Ford Excursion, another financial crisis hit and a new market segment evolved.
That evolution we're talking about is, of course, the crossover. These things are the bane of many a car lover's existence.
Not mine!
Particularly among truck and SUV enthusiasts, also sports car people and
haters
everyone
gonna
else.
Hate. Haters gonna hate.
People hate on crossovers because they look like something they're not, but there are good reasons why the family market loves them. I can't wait to talk about my favorite crossover. We'll get into it. Technically, crossovers have existed for a long, long time. Like we mentioned before, the idea of using a small car platform to build a larger vehicle was what led to the minivan. And if you go by today's definition of a crossover SUV, then the 1934 Ford Tudor sedan technically counts as one. The rise of crossovers as a family vehicle is much more recent, and again, coincides with global circumstances. A worldwide recession in the mid-2000s hit American car companies particularly hard. And at the same time, another oil crisis and escalating climate concerns tanked the SUV market. Not only was owning an Escalade a billionaire-style luxury, it suddenly became billionaire-style unethical. But the American car companies recovered, mainly because they were bailed out by the government, but also because they adapted to the market by creating smaller, cheaper, more efficient crossovers that kind of looked like their big bro SUVs, but didn't carry the same price tag or stigma. The point is that the Ford Escape usurped the Explorer's marketplace, while the Chevy Equinox did the same to the Tahoe, etc., etc.
My parents had an Equinox for a long time.
Huh? I used to work out at Equinox.
Did you?
Yeah. I'm making fun of how you said it, but yeah, I used to.
Equinox?
Equinox.
Equinox. Whatever. Fuck. I don't give a shit.
It means equal.
But the Honda CR-V was really the crossover SUV that became the proof of concept success to other car companies. When it was introduced in the late 90s, the CR-V gave families gas mileage close to the Honda Civic, but with way more space than a Civic could provide. Families soon discovered that they didn't need huge SUVs, just bigger, compact cars. The Subaru Outback is arguably the definitive crossover. It started as a modified Subaru Legacy in wagon form, and with a few more inches of ground clearance. But the Outback became its own entity in 2000, and today it's grown to 16 feet long and looks like an SUV without actually being one. But it still has enough clearance and the all-wheel drive necessary to make it practical for families in harsh climates and or extremely long, dangerous driveways like those in the Pacific Northwest.
It's weird because I would consider it an SUV. It's capable. It's pretty high up. It does look like a wagon, though. That's the only thing.
And it's not based on a truck platform, though.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They made like a legacy sedan. Have you ever seen one of those things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
So sick. Not really. They are very weird looking. Today, crossovers are the best-selling segment in the auto industry, making up 22.8% of all new cars sold in 2021. They're so popular that car companies are slapping everything from Bronco to Blazer to Mustang badges onto crossovers these days. Bronco Sport, little crossover.
Little crossover.
Great car. Great Blazer, car. Haven't driven one. I don't really know. Mustang Mach-E, great car. Not a Mustang.
Doesn't look good.
Not really. The one we had for Omaze a couple months ago, it has like some appearance package. It had a body kit on it. I liked it. I thought it looked pretty good. But yeah, I think they need it. You know, the refresh will probably look a lot better. James, you have a crossover. You have a little Tiguan.
It's like a big fat Golf.
Yeah. I mean, it probably is, right?
It is.
It's just a fat
little
Golf.
Bubble.
Just a big Golf. It's got a Golf engine. It's got KW V3s on it.
Yeah.
Got Rotiforms on it. Got Toyos on it.
Got sport mode. That thing is quick.
It is. It's just like a GTI.
Yeah.
Stealth mode.
I have stealth mode.
Does that? Yeah. My favorite crossover is the Mazda CX-5.
I think that all the Mazda crossovers are really good looking.
Yeah.
If anyone that is not a car person, like friends and family, ask me what car they should get, I always say Mazda.
Me too.
CX-5. Yeah.
And they always get it and they love it.
It's great
and
looking.
You get to look like a hero. Yeah.
So the interiors are really nice.
Yeah.
The like infotainment is like above and beyond.
I'm kind of smitten with the new CX-50 that I think
that's like the lifted one, right?
Yeah, and it's got a little like plastic cladding. I think they're coming for like the Crosstrek market.
Yeah, definitely.
But it looks
way
sick.
Nicer on the inside.
I like plastic cladding.
Mazdas are super nice on the inside, super comfortable. I mean, I think
great screens.
Mm-hmm.
Mazda, really one of the best screens.
And you know what? It's a fun little car. Like it's not Miata, obviously, but it feels it's a Mazda. You know when you drive it.
You know who has a?
I definitely will have one.
Jinbei Atai,
horse and rider.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Right. It's Mazda's ethos.
Yep. Oh, but you know who doesn't have great screens? The Civic Type R.
Mm-mm.
Pretty bad screens.
That's a
silly car.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
We like to think of the car industry as constantly evolving, but if we zoom out for a second, don't crossover SUVs kind of look like station wagons? Think about that definition from earlier. Generally car-shaped, but with the roof extended backward over a passenger and or cargo space that can be accessed through a rear door. Does it sound familiar, people? Follow the money.
Follow the money. If you're not scared, you're not paying attention.
If you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for nothing.
How many boobs does it take to choke a dog?
Sure. Advances in technology and aesthetic taste make today's crossover sleeker than old-fashioned wagons, but the concept is remarkably similar. Now they're just called sport wagons or crossovers to avoid the embarrassing stigmas of the past.
Ultimately, these classifications of station wagon versus SUV versus crossover mean more to car companies than they do to the average consumer. Even the idea of a family car might not mean the same thing that it used to, thanks to evolving definitions of the word family itself.
Huh.
Like, I'd consider you guys my family.
I consider you guys family.
Yeah, we're family. And even though I don't own a dog, I do consider myself a dog dad. The future of the family car might hinge on some new idea like the magic door gate. Or because gas prices are higher than ever, maybe crossovers will shrink even further. On the flip side, the rise of electric technology could support cars that are bigger than ever. Biggest cars, big as a house. I want the biggest car ever. Maybe those tall, boxy Euro vans that are popping up everywhere could be the next thing, although I doubt it. Or maybe we missed the point with this episode entirely, and we haven't even touched on the real family car. After all, the best-selling vehicle for the past 30 years running isn't a station wagon, a minivan, an SUV, or a crossover. It's the Ford F-150. So maybe pickup trucks have been the real family car all along.
Oh. Dang.
Or maybe the family car was under our noses this entire time.
Oh.
And it's not a car at all. It's a boat. Who knows? What matters more than the make and model of your family car are the memories you make along the way.
Oh.
And the stale French fries you shove into the seat.
Oh, nice little wrap up. Wow.
Yeah. Wait, why are you shoving them into the seat? They just drop.
I don't know. Bored.
All right. Well, that was an awesome story.
Awesome story.
Mazda CX-5.
Great riffs. Mazda CX-5. Volkswagen Tiguan.
Mustang of the skies.
Mustang of the sky. P51 Mustang. Cadillac of the sky. We got some fan mail. This is from Carl with a K, which is, in my opinion, the best way to spell
it. That's the best way.
If you're a Carl with a C, sorry, but your wife probably knows karate. Hi there. Big fan of the podcast. Been listening since the launch of the podcast.
Nice. Thanks.
My idea for an episode is about the auto renter companies, Avis, Hertz, etc., which do have both positives, Hertz special editions, and negatives, Grand Theft Auto charges. He also has a correction for the Fordlandia episode when Nolan mentioned that Walt Disney went down to Brazil to see the district, and that was the inspiration for Disneyland. Well, Walt Disney and his animators did go to South America. That was in 1941, and the inspiration for Disneyland was visiting the Henry Ford Greenfield Village in Dearborn in 1948 while going to a model train convention. Fordlandia was already abandoned 7 years before Walt Disney visited South America.
Whoa, good correction.
Yeah, that's a good one. I look forward to every new episode, even if Nolan is an idiot that gets things wrong all the time. And I tell everyone I talk to if they're interested in auto industry figures events. So I ask them to listen to Pot.
Well,
Pass Gas.
Thank you, Carl, for spreading the good word.
Yeah, thanks, Carl.
P.S. for Joe, did you ever go to the Milwaukee Mile Racetrack?
Ooh, yeah, I went, I think, one time as a kid.
Don't remember it much.
I probably had a hot dog. I probably was underprepared for ear protection.
Do they have the trough-style urinals?
Of course they do.
I don't like them.
You like them?
I don't like them.
Why?
They're all pissing in the same thing.
Yeah. What's the big deal?
I love the feel of the heat coming off of it.
I lay down in it sometimes.
Okay.
But also, here's another tidbit. Walt Disney also got inspiration from Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown LA for Disneyland.
What?
Because
really?
It's like a crazy bar that's been around since the 20s.
The four-story one?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's four stories with a giant fake tree going through the top.
Make you wear
of it.
A collared shirt to get into the,
really?
Yeah,
the bar. Yeah, it's stupid.
What?
Yeah.
I went,
dumb.
Went there I right a before a pandemic hit. It was a great
fuck
night.
Clifton's. Fuck Clifton's, fuck Walt Disney, fuck Henry Ford. I'm James Pumphrey. You can follow me on social media at James Pumphrey. You can follow Joe at Joe G. Weber, Nolan at Nolan J. Sykes. If you don't already know, we have a YouTube channel called Dona Media. We make videos and we upload them a bunch of times a week. Check out our new podcast that Nolan is hosting.
Yeah.
Along with two very funny and smart people. Called DRS, Donut Racing Show, where he talks about F1 right after the race.
Mm-hmm.
Super fun. Wednesdays.
That baby.
Peep it out. Keep it out, people.
Keep it out with your ears.
All right. You can email us at passgas@donutmedia.com. Let us know how many boobs it takes to choke a dog.
All right.
All right. Later.